It's down there where the missiles came from. They're on the move. They're headed toward where Rivera and Zheng are coming down. We need to help them. Are you sure? He asked. Are you asking because you're not sure what to do? She demanded. Or because you're worried I will think it's a stupid idea? The last one, he admitted. Honey, we don't have combat skin suits. These flight suits only have limited power assist, and our helmets don't have all the squad tactical link and targeting features. The pilots had rifles attached to their seats with a spare magazine and two grenades each. That was considered enough for them to escape and evade until they were picked up by a search and rescue unit, but their training emphasized avoiding contact with the enemy. The last time I played soldier on the ground was back in boot camp, he said. You remember any of it? Enough. Okay, if we're doing this, we need to go now. His visor was showing him that setting down on the proper side of the river was less and less certain by the second. Do it. Irene altered the designated landing zone, had a brief argument with the ejection seat's computer, confirmed the change, and saw that Derek was now attempting to land near her. Their seats would coordinate to avoid fouling the two parachutes. There wasn't anything she needed to do. That left her mind idle and available to dream up bad thoughts like, what exactly were they going to do on the ground? Two pilots without powered armor and limited experience in fighting on the ground against four experienced armored Wargalan ground pounders, plus Irene and Derek needed to find and protect two injured people. Those were not great odds. Derek's seat blew the aeroshell, then severed the straps and set him free when he was less than 60 meters from the ground, the computer having calculated that the best option was for the pilot to complete the last leg of the journey on his own. Several trees had blown over, leaving a gap in the forest canopy, and the parachute guided him through the gap. It was up to him where to place his feet as he came down through dead branches that snatched at his suit. He pushed off a downed tree trunk and rolled, coming to a stop with only enough of a jolt to cause a sharp pain in his back. Quickly, he palmed the button to release him from the parachute, and the fabric began to dissolve. His rifle had come down with him, along with a survival pack containing spare ammunition, grenades, power cells, food, a small solar panel, and other gear a downed pilot might need in a breathable atmosphere. Satisfied his back injury was probably just a pulled muscle, he checked his visor for Irene's location and set off at a steady run, brushing aside the undergrowth. Irene's seat had determined her best option was to stay strapped in, so the bottom of the seat took the impact of falling down through the trees. Branches thin and thick were battered out of the way, one tree limb stout enough to bring the seat to a halt 4 meters off the forest floor before the limb cracked under the weight and the seat rolled away to plunge the final distance to the ground. The impact was cushioned by the parachute tether, and the aeroshell around the seat acted as an airbag. Still, Irene's brain was rattled, and she came to a rest upside down. She got unstrapped and was awkwardly extricating herself from the shell when Derek jogged up, panting. Hey, he said, looking around warily, careful to keep the muzzle of his rifle pointed at the ground. Don't even, Irene ordered as she rolled to her feet, wiping mud away from her face with one hand and wagging a finger at him with the other. Don't what? He asked innocently. Don't say it. I wasn't going to say anything, he protested. Okay, maybe I was about to say it's good to see you. Oh, sorry. Hey, he grinned, pointing to the still rigid shell around the upside-down seat draped with the parachute tethers. These things should come with a big yellow arrow labeled this end up, he winked. I said, don't say it, she laughed anyway, ducking back in the shell to get her rifle and survival pack. How long should I set the self-destruct timer for? About that. Derek held up the bright yellow destruct charge he had pulled from the remains of his own seat. I've got a plan. Chapter 14 This, Santinelli grunted when the G-meter in his visor hit 3.6, is better than, he gasped for breath, riding the ship down? You can, Dave had to pause for breath, get out any time you want. Ah, he grunted, tensing his ab muscles. Even through the skin suit, the webbing of straps that held him in place were cutting into him every place they crisscrossed over and around his arms, legs, and torso. The skin suit itself was compressing around his legs and forearms, keeping blood from pooling there, but he still felt lightheaded, and he felt like an elephant was sitting on his chest.
Nerd, why are we falling so fast?
Objects fall at the same speed, regardless of mass.
The alien cadet gently chided the human for not understanding a simple principle of physics.
Same speed.
Shauna's vision was narrowing, the edges going gray from her brain getting less oxygen than she needed.
In a vacuum.
Oh, yes, that is true,
Nert admitted, embarrassed. His genetically engineered physiology, plus the advanced nanomachines in his blood, gave him a better ability to tolerate high-gravity loads. That did not mean he was comfortable. It did not mean he wasn't scared, despite the confident tone he tried to project in his voice.
This thing?
Dave tried to point to the shell around them, but his wrist didn't want to move.
It's barely loaded. Air resistance on this big shell should have us falling gently.
We are falling gently, Nert insisted. We are experiencing only,
he glanced at his own G-meter,
3.8 gravities.
His meter was based on the slightly lower gravity of the Ruhar homeworld.
Only?
Santinelli groaned.
Yes.
Nert nodded once, the strain on his neck muscles telling him that was a bad idea.
These cargo pods normally fall at 7 gravities. They have to fall quickly to reduce the time they can be targeted by enemy weapons on the ground.
Great.
Dave closed his eyes. The pod was shaking as it fell, and the smart fibers of the webbing that held him securely near the center of the pod dampened only part of the effect. He still felt it, and the roaring of the pod battering its way down through increasingly thick air was transmitted through the webbing so he felt it in his bones.
If it helps, this is the highest gravity we will experience,
Nert offered cheerily.
I think,
he corrected his own overconfidence.
It should be.
The truth was, he had never ridden inside a cargo pod, nor had he ever heard of anyone doing such a foolish thing. The pods were blunt-shaped, unpowered shells designed to bring equipment and supplies on a one-way trip to the surface of any world with a reasonably thick atmosphere. He really had zero experience with cargo pods at all. Everything he knew about them was in the limited set of data stored in his helmet.
Great, Dave repeated.
It had been his idea for the group to get into a cargo pod, a fancy composite box that was better than the simple pine box that awaited them if they couldn't find a way to get dirtside safely. It had taken 3 tries to find a cargo launch bay that wasn't damaged or already empty. Then they, meaning Nert, had to manually override the controls to launch the 2 loaded pods in the bay before the 4 humans, 1 Verdkris and 1 Ruhar, climbed into one of the 2 empty pods. They were fortunate that some of the pods were kept empty to be loaded later with whatever the ground force decided they needed most to sustain the operation. The pod was not completely empty. They had stuffed in extra skin suits, a box of spare power cells, 3 rifles, and a crate of ammunition, plus a box of ration bars for the humans. Basically, they tossed in whatever was close at hand that they might need and could find quickly. Very quickly. By the time they crawled into the pod and Nert started to get it sealed up, the turbulence of the broken ship's passage through the atmosphere was sending hot gases through the open launch bay door. Chowdhury had been pulled off her feet and would have been sucked out the door if Santinelli had not gotten a solid grip on her belt and a stanchion. It had taken both Dave and Shauna to get the other 2 humans into the pod, and still the sides of the pod nearly clamped down on Chowdhury's left leg before Shauna yanked her inside at the last moment. Even with the smart fibers of the webbing helping the passengers get into position, they were still struggling to secure themselves away from the walls of the pod when it screeched down the warped launch rails and was flung out into space. Immediately the pod hit something, or something struck it, and it went into an uncontrolled spin that had Dave fighting to keep his stomach from rebelling. After the impact, the pod had tumbled intermittently until it fell deep enough in the atmosphere for aerodynamics to act, pointing the pod's blunt nose downward. Since then, they only had to endure crushing deceleration and vibration that felt like it was shaking his teeth loose.
Riding the cargo pod to the surface was less risky than the certain death of staying aboard the broken ship. It was still very risky. Normally, the pod would rely on guidance from the ship above, and it would be accompanied by its own squadron of decoys. At any moment, an enemy missile or maser beam could shatter the shell, dumping the passengers out into the hypersonic airstream that would tear them apart. If that happened, death would be mercifully swift. Dave checked the G-force meter. It had dropped below 3. He waited until it fell below 2.6, the point where his body could feel the difference, before daring to give voice to his hopes.
"We're through the worst of—"
The pod was battered sideways so violently that he blacked out for a moment. When he was able to think again, the pod was spinning and vibrating worse than ever, enough that some of the tough webbing was pulling free from the inner walls.
"They're shooting at us!" Santinelli screamed. "We're dead!"
"Shut up, Santi," Dave barked.
"Nert, any way we can see outside this thing?"
"What? You think that will help?"
Santinelli's panic was out of control.
"We can't dodge a missile even if we can see it."
"I don't think that was a missile," Dave explained.
"What?"
Shauna asked.
"I'm pretty sure that was turbulence from the ship falling past us. We were both falling at the same rate, and the launcher didn't kick us very far away before we hit the atmosphere."
"Yeah," Shauna thought for a moment.
"That makes sense. Damn it. I know this thing has sensors. The freaking hamsters won't let my suit connect."
Nert was stung by her words.
"You are not locked out because you are human, Staff Sergeant Jarrett. You just don't know how to do it," he said with a pout. "I do. I have it. Connecting you now?"
The view was fuzzy and indistinct, coming from long antennas that stuck out to the sides and top of the pod. Sensors in the blunt nose of the cargo container were surrounded by a pink fog of superheated plasma as the pod battered its way down through the thicker and thicker air. At first, Dave couldn't understand what he was seeing. Then the image resolved itself.
"Shit!" he groaned.
"Yeah, that's the ship. What's left of it?"
The remains of the forward hull section had raced past them, and remains was the correct description. It had split apart into two large and dozens of smaller pieces, all racing toward the ground much faster than the cargo pod. All of the debris was engulfed in flame, soot, and plasma, breaking apart as it fell.
"We don't have to worry about someone shooting at us,"
Shauna found the silver lining in the situation.
"There's so much debris flying around up here, the Wargalin wouldn't know what to target."
"Oh,"
Santinelli snickered nervously.
"Cool.
Nert,"
Dave said slowly.
"Can we steer this thing?"
The cadet thought for a moment.
"I don't know. Cargo pods usually follow a guidance beam projected from the ground with backup from the ship. Why?"
"Because."
Dave couldn't tear his eyes away from the mesmerizing images of what used to be the Big Mac.
"When all that fast-moving shit below us hits the ground, it will leave a big smoking crater. We do not want to land there."
"Shit,"
the cadet agreed.
"I don't know if it can be steered from here. Let me try."
They waited in silence as best they could. The turbulent air in the wake of the starship's forward hull tossed the pod around violently, making it difficult for Dave to keep a train of thought.
"Dave," Shauna called, "check Jates. He doesn't look so good."
He checked the big bird Chris's vital signs, which indeed did not look good at all. Blood pressure was low, and their leader had been unconscious since the pod had struck something right after launch.
"His suit is showing yellow, not even orange," Dave noted hopefully. "It probably knocked him out on purpose. Best thing for him right now."
"Maybe.
Verds are tough, that's good."
"Shauna? Dave?"
Nert called, forgetting protocol. Not that it mattered at the moment.
"I think I found how to provide landing coordinates for the pod. It should guide itself."
"Outstanding."
Dave relished the first solidly good news he had heard since the Big Mac had been hit the first time.
"Do you have a destination?"
Nert asked, not wanting to take on that responsibility. Dave checked the map in his visor. The device was showing only a vague location for their current position.
"Hell, we don't want to fall into the ocean," he muttered to himself. Is there any way to see on this thing where the ship will hit?
I don't think so. His frustration boiled over. I don't know how to use this system. I've never seen it before.
Nerdy. Shauna did her best to calm the cadet. It's okay. You're doing great. Way better than we could. Look, we've fallen in a southwesterly direction, following the ship down. We've got ocean to the west. Can you steer us north? Anywhere to the north that is dry land?
Sure. I'll try.
Nothing happened at first. Then, still nothing happened. Nerd? Dave asked as they fell through 20 kilometers. The ship below and in front of them was breaking apart faster, but two big chunks were holding together and would make a huge crater when they hit.
Working on it,
the teenager snapped.
Got it!
The pod's uncontrolled rocking motion steadied as fins deployed from the top, stabilizing the flight path. Straps dug in hard as the pod jerked in the air, swaying side to side, each motion wobbling less than the last. The container rotated around them as the fins tilted, bringing the cargo container swinging around so it was falling a bit more toward the north with every meter it plunged. With nothing else to do, Dave tried to relax, conserving his energy for the upcoming battle on the ground. Based on the map, they would land far from any friendly support. Their best hope was to find a place to hole up until they could get a signal through to a rescue team. As they fell through 12 kilometers, he realized he was thinking not about if they landed, but what they would do after. He was assuming their crazy stunt would work, setting them down gently enough to be survivable. The trembling started as the pod raced through 11 kilometers. Gentle when it began, the vibration built up until Dave's teeth were chattering.
What is wrong?
I think,
Nert had to shout even to hear himself.
One of the fins is damaged!
Dave looked up and was about to say something like, no shit, Sherlock, when a bright hole appeared at the upper end of the pod. A fin had torn away, taking part of the shell with it. Instantly, the roaring grew so loud that Dave could barely hear himself think. Loss of the fin caused the pod to swerve in the air, jerking left and right as the computer tried to compensate for the missing fin and keep to the programmed flight path. Above them, the tear in the shell grew wider.
Nerd! Turn off the guidance, Dave shouted.
What?
Stop!
Dave made a slashing motion across the neck of his suit. Nert was being bounced around in the webbing so badly he could barely bring up the menu in his visor. It was impossible to select icons with his eyes dancing in his skull, so he fell back to the pad on his left wrist. Instead of trying to control the pod, he resorted to simply turning off the guidance system. The trembling dampened immediately, but the pod then started to spin, faster and faster. Was all Shauna could say. Nert gave up trying to explain and just concentrated on engaging the gyroscopes. It didn't work correctly. It worked well enough. Rotation slowed to a rate that was merely nausea-inducing rather than rendering the occupants unconscious.
That's the best I can do for now?
Great!
Dave took gulps of air to keep his stomach contents where they should be.
Oh, this is gonna be close!
He highlighted the area the pod was falling toward. It was right on the seacoast.
We'll make it!
Shauna expressed confidence she didn't really feel.
Dave?
Nert spoke hesitantly.
We might have another problem. Two problems.
What is it this time?
First, we... Hang on!
When the aft section of the Big Mac impacted, it created a twin. Connected craters 100 meters deep and over a kilometer across. A fountain of soil, soot, ash, and pieces of starship fountained up in a mushroom cloud, while the air was pushed aside in a supersonic wave in all directions. The shockwave pummeled the cargo container, pushing it northwest, and even making it briefly gain 500 meters of altitude. All Dave knew was they had survived. Somehow they were still alive, the pod was mostly in one piece, and they were falling again. He had to admire the toughness of Ruhar equipment. The hamsters knew what they were doing. The altimeter showed them soaring down through 8 kilometers.
Everyone okay?
He asked, even as he checked four other sets of vital signs. Everyone was alive. Jaitz and now Chowdhury were unconscious, their suits having made the judgment call that inducing temporary forced sleep was best for the occupants.
Fine.
Shauna decided right then that she would not go on a roller coaster or any other wild carnival ride ever again.
I am well.
Even Nert's voice was shaky.
I'm here.
Santinelli was resentful.
Hey.
Dave figured that since no one was dead, he might as well deliver the bad news.
We got another problem. That shockwave pushed us out to sea. We're going to splash down in the ocean. Looks like about 7 clicks from shore. That's way too far for swimming.
Nert?
Shauna looked down at the precious gear stowed in the nose of the pod.
The fins are busted, but can you steer the parachute after it deploys? That was the second problem I was going to tell you,
Nert groaned.
The parachute was torn away, either when we got hit after launch or when the fin broke loose. The backup chute is showing offline.
Checking his helmet visor, Dave read altitude and airspeed. They were 7.5 kilometers up and falling at just below the speed of sound. That was survivable.
We gotta get out of here,
Dave declared, mentally awarding himself a no-shit Sherlock.
Nert, can you blow this shell?
Yes, I can activate the release mechanism. But we will fall.
No, we won't, because 4 of us have parachutes, Dave said. Nert, you take Chowdhury, okay?
Yes. Yes, I can do that.
Outstanding.
He almost said Schmuckatelli without thinking.
Santi, get yourself attached to the Sergeant. He's your ride down.
Me?
Santinelli protested.
Why don't you take him?
Because Jarrett and I are going to tether ourselves to the gear we brought.
Dave pointed toward the nose of the pod below them.
Hell, I don't have to take orders from a civilian,
Santinelli protested.
That lizard weighs a ton. He will drag me.
Do we have a problem, Santinelli?
Shauna demanded.
I'm not a civilian, and you do have to take orders from me. Now get yourself attached to Jaitz, or I'll give him your parachute.
The hapless Lance Corporal grumbled under his breath as he grudgingly worked at the task he didn't want to perform. Dave checked the tether holding Santinelli to the Verdcris as best he could from a distance, and when everybody declared they were ready, he told Nert to get ready to blow open the shell.
Everyone remember, release yourself from the webbing, then toggle only your drogue chute to pull you out. Do not activate your main chute until you are clear. Open the chute manually. We need to make sure we don't get tangled in a bunch of crap flying around.
Wait.
Nert, how does this work?
The shell?
Nert asked, confused.
It splits open down its length, Shauna said. We've seen them used for vert rep plenty of times before.
The Ruhar had used cargo pods to perform vertical replenishment on Fresno after the fighting started, with starships launching pods from a safe distance and letting them coast down to the planet's surface.
On the ground, yeah,
Dave pressed his question.
What will happen when we blow it apart in flight?
Oh, good point,
Nert conceded.
I do not know. It could be dangerous.
Maybe not,
Shauna countered, painfully aware of how close they were getting to the ground.
I read somewhere these things can be used to resupply special ops troops. They carry stealth subcontainers that can glide down on their own. When they do that, the subcontainers are released out the top.
I can try that,
Nert frowned. The humans were asking him to do everything, and it wasn't fair. It was impossible to...
I can do that, he said with surprise. The pod is made of sections like rings. They are held...
Nert, just do it,
Dave urged.
3, 2, 1?
The cadet did his best to speak calmly.
Break!
Exactly as Nert tried to explain, the pod's top dome and a ring 3 meters in depth suddenly peeled away, and just as suddenly, he and Chowdhury were pulled upward as his drogue chute shot up and yanked them with it. Shauna went next, the suit computers coordinating the bailout operation faster and safer than any biological being could have. Dave braced himself, one hand on the latch that would cut the tether to the bag of equipment he had dangling below him. Santinelli and Jaitz were next in the automated sequence, or they tried to go next. Somehow, Schmuckatelli lived up to his name by failing to get all the webbing released properly. He got tangled up with the big bird, the drogue chute tugging him upward while the netting tried to hold both of them in place. The nanofibers of the netting were smart enough to realize the strain was going to tear the two biologicals apart, so they disintegrated, and Santinelli popped upward like a cork. He twirled in midair, striking the lip of the pod hard and tearing free from Jates. Dave got a flash impression of Jates tumbling out of control and out of sight as his visor registered a red deceased over the icon for Santinelli. Shit! He did not have time to complete the thought before his own drogue shot upward. All Dave could do was haul on the handle to release the tether holding him to the gear bag, and he was free, flying through the near supersonic airstream that hit him like a solid wall, making him tumble out of control. Drogue. He had to get the drogue retracted. How the hell did that work? He had done it in training, but not often. It was rarely used emergency procedure, reserved for when the drogue was fouled on itself or some foreign object. Screw it. He didn't have time to mess around with equipment. Yanking another tab, he cut the drogue free and tucked his legs, rolling over to fall head first. When David Jacob Chaika signed up for the Army, he had promised his mother he would not apply for airborne service because jumping out of an airplane was insanity. Sorry, Mom, he apologized to her as he desperately scanned the air below for the Verdcris Sergen, and saw nothing. Oh! He saw Jates not with his naked eyes, but with the team position locator in his visor. There was a slowly tumbling dot below and to the west, barely outlined against the blue water of the sea. Dave lost sight of the Verd for a moment as the Sergen plunged into a cloud layer. Then Dave fell into and through the same clouds. Oh, shit! Even if he caught Jates, they were both going to land in the water. He tucked his arms back to pick up speed and used his legs to steer the glide path. Dave, Shauna called. What are you doing? Don't ask. Dave's muscles were so paralyzed with fear he could barely speak. Jates, he's in free fall. You'll both die if he's alive. He could hear her take a deep breath. Okay, be careful. You're going to splash down in the water, you know that? What about you? The shape of Jates resolved itself into a figure falling on its back, arms and legs extended limply above by the force of the air. We can make it to the beach or inland. Dave, we're going to pop chutes in a sec. Got it. Any friendlies in the area? No one in the area. This coast looks deserted. Map isn't showing the squids have anything along here. Gotta go. I need to focus. Hey, tell Em I love her. I will tell her you're an idiot. That too. Chaika out. He fell, annoyingly slower and slower as his initial velocity bled off against air resistance. Jates had to be falling slower as the Verd was not in a streamlined stance. 4 kilometers. His visor was screaming warnings at him to pop the chute, continuously asking whether he truly wanted to delay deployment. He ignored it, knowing the suit computer would eventually override his manual control and pop the chute whether he wanted it or not. But not yet. 3.5. 3 kilometers. Less than 10,000 feet before he hit the water. 2.5. Then Jates was right there in front of him, and Dave had to rotate from face down to flying on his belly, using his arms and legs to steer toward the unconscious figure. He missed the first time, flying cleanly past. The second time he swung past, smacked his legs against Jates, and spun away out of control. 1.5 kilometers. Less than 5,000 feet to go. A message warning parachute emergency deployment imminent popped up in his visor, and he ignored it. There wasn't anything he could do to prevent the suit's tiny brain from protecting him from his own lunacy. Not now, damn it! He screamed into his helmet. Salty tears clouding his vision. I can do this! 3rd time was the charm. He hit hard enough to knock the air from his lungs and hang on with a powered suit death grip. As charms went, that one sucked because he had gotten hold of Jates upside down and backwards so the Verd's backside was under Dave's chin and his thighs flopping around in Dave's face. The Maverick got his legs wrapped around Jates' torso and did not dare let go even one arm to attempt tying a strap around them. he would have to trust. The chute deployed without warning, and suddenly he was holding not just Jates, but 1,000 tons of dead weight as the chute abruptly brought him almost to a stop in midair. The suit must have sensed his wishes, because the powered arms and legs clamped solidly without giving an inch, holding on to Jates even when Dave's own limbs could not take the strain. Then it seemed they were hanging motionless in the air. Blue ocean glittered below Dave's feet, long swells that curled into white as they crashed on the shore. The parachute above them was a parachute, not a balloon, and it had formed into sort of a triangle shape. The wind was pushing them farther from the shore. It would be a long swim. He briefly debated trying to steer the chute, but didn't have confidence in his ability to control the overloaded fabric. Now that he was used to the different motion of dangling beneath the chute, he could sense he was still falling, just at a slower rate. A bar at the corner of the visor was showing orange for their rate of descent. The bulk of Jates and his skin suit, plus rifle, had the parachute close to its limit. Dave realized the ocean was approaching fast, faster than he had expected. It was going to be a hard landing after all. Keeping one eye on the altimeter that was scrolling down faster than he liked, he considered whether to ditch his and Jates's rifles to lessen the parachute's load. No. Smacking into the water would likely hurt like hell, but it was survivable. Being dirtside in a combat zone without a weapon was suicide. Okay. Sorry about this, he said quietly, as the altimeter showed he was 6 meters above the water, and he let Jates drop. The big bird fell head first and only flipped onto his back just before hitting the water with a splash that sent up a fountain.
Shit!
Dave had expected the Surgeon's suit would deploy airbags to keep him afloat, but the alien slipped beneath the waves and was just gone, leaving only a ripple. With only Dave's weight, the parachute had warped its shape out into a balloon that expanded rapidly with helium gas, and he was drifting slowly upward. The damn parachute computer was trying to get him to shore. Having no time to argue, he pulled the emergency latch to break free of the chute entirely and gulped when he saw his rash move happened when he was almost 10 meters above the ocean swells. Oh, this is not good. He hit the waves feet first, the suit tensing the boots to prevent him from shattering his ankles. Down, down, down he plunged, until the suit judged it was safe to inflate flotation bags from his shoulders. The bags inflated slowly so he wouldn't rocket to the surface out of control. Damn. The surface was a long way above him. The bright sunlight dimmed and changed color so it looked bluish-gray. He knew his suit had plenty of oxygen, and that did nothing to dampen an instinctive panic that he had to force from his mind.
No, damn it.
He barked at the suit. He did not want to float up to the surface. He needed to locate Jates in the water first. The stupid visor was not cooperating, making him scroll through a menu to deactivate the floats, and he broke the surface before he could get the damned things retracted. Jates. Where was Jates? Skin suits had a maximum safe depth that Dave could not remember at the moment. He also didn't know how deep the ocean floor was in that area. The helmet-to-helmet laser link's range degraded quickly underwater. The squad locator beacon might not... Huh. A flash of yellow when Dave bobbed up on a swell. It was gone when he slid down the backside of the wave. With steady, smooth strokes assisted by the power suit, he swam toward where he had seen the glimpse of yellow, a color that was not natural on the sea surface. It was Jates.
I'm an idiot.
Dave felt like slapping his forehead. Jates's suit was smart. It had waited until the Verd soldier's plunge under the surface slowed before inflating. Just like Dave's suit had done. Taking a moment to do something smart rather than just doing something, Dave checked Jates's vital signs. They looked better. Blood pressure was up, heart rate steady, breathing normal. There was a problem. Jates's suit had a tear on the right side. A tear large enough that the nanofibers had not been able to completely seal that gap. Water had seeped into the suit, which was not a problem because the tropical ocean surface was warm like bathwater. The leaking suit was not an immediate problem. The flotation bags were compensating. But it would make Jades even heavier to tow to the beach. Swimming over behind the Surgeon, Dave got an arm around the alien's upper body and waited to ride the top of a swell so he could see which direction was the shore. His visor had that info on a map. It just felt better to see it. After only a few minutes of swimming, during which Dave was already getting tired of Jaitz's rifle bumping into his churning legs, the alien made a sound. Jaitz sighed, his eyelids fluttering.
Hey, Jaitz! Sergen, you awake in there? Dave asked excitedly.
The alien grunted. Depends.
Depends? On what?
Dave was baffled. Feels like I'm in water somewhere. And it's warm.
Yeah, that's right, so?
So, if I open my eyes and see that you're with me in a hot tub, the Verd Chris paused. All I can say is you better run.
Oh! Dave laughed with relief. No hot tub.
You'd better not be buck naked either.
Ah, I'm wearing a combat skin suit, not my birthday suit,
he assured the big bird.
Hey, come on. Open your eyes, will ya? We splashed down in the ocean and we have to get to shore. It's awkward towing your fat ass through the water.
My ass is not fat. Jaitz opened his eyes to glare at the human. This suit has padding.
Yeah, it's the suit's fault, Dave muttered. Can you swim?
Chapter 15.
Incoming, the Ruhar co-pilot of the dropship carrying a Verd Chris platoon announced, feeling useless. There wasn't anything he could do about the enemy missiles that had targeted them, and even his announcement was unnecessary. The pilot had the same info flashing across her helmet visor. They were both ignoring calls by the Verd Chris soldiers in the cabin. The lone human passenger, Captain Grace, had not tried to contact the pilots who didn't have time to talk anyway. The whole operation was snakebit right from the start. First, their ship, the assault carrier Dahl Ternaden, had drawn the unpopular assignment of ferrying a battalion of Verd Chris. Then, he and the pilot had gotten the bonus of having a human in their dropship, so they had two untrustworthy types of aliens to worry about. To make their day complete, the Dahl Ternaden had been sliced in half by an enemy SD network the 7th Fleet apparently had missed, and debris from the carrier had knocked out the dropship's engines, peppered the hull with holes, and taken the aft defensive maser turret offline.
Intercept confidence? The pilot asked, not taking her focus off the flight controls.
68% for the first missile, co-pilot Randero reported. 42 for the second. They're coming in perfectly spaced, he grunted.
The enemy apparently had updated information about the defensive capabilities of Ruhar assault dropships, information they must have obtained from the Kristang. The first missile knew it had a less than even chance of a successful hit, so it had slowed its approach to give the second missile a better opportunity. If the data about Wargalan anti-air tactics was correct, the first missile would sacrifice itself by self-destructing, sending a cloud of sensor-blinding chaff into the air and blocking the dropship's view of the second weapon until it was too late.
Let's close the gap, Pilot Lolenda ordered, dipping the nose down to build up airspeed.
With the engines offline, gravity was their only way to gain speed.
Got it.
Co-pilot Randero didn't argue. He had attended the same briefing about how to deal with Wargalan air defense missiles. The book on tactics also suggested firing the maser cannons early, hoping to confuse the lead missile into exploding early.
Firing the chin turret?
In the cockpit, they heard the distinctive bzz-bzz sound of the maser beams sizzling through the air, and Randero saw another query from the Verd Chris platoon leader. He ignored it. The Verd had access to a data feed from the cockpit, and the pilots were too busy to babysit their passengers. It was a battle of technology against technology, tactics against tactics. The Ruhar dropship's defensive sensor and fire control system against the tiny brain of the enemy missiles. The tactical advice provided by the Torgala to the Ruhar against the tactical advice provided by the Kristang to the Wargalan. The actions of biological beings, no matter how smart or skilled, could have little effect on the outcome of the deadly contest. Unless the pilots of the dropship did something stupid. Pointing the dropship straight at the incoming missile certainly seemed stupid to Randero, and it went against his instincts to monitor sensors and weapons while Lalenda flew the plunging spacecraft almost straight down.
Bzz, bzz, bzz.
The chin turret's maser cannons were in rapid-fire mode, sending out coherent pulses of microwave energy whenever the fire control computer thought it could predict the next move of the leading missile. Both missiles flew a weaving path to avoid providing an easy target, a sensible precaution. Sensible, but not always successful.
Bzz, bam!
The lead missile flew into a maser beam that fried the weapon's electronics, a strike that rendered it useless and prematurely detonating the warhead. Millions of pieces of sensor-jamming chaff were flung outward in a cone shape, some pieces burning hot to confuse sensors in the infrared range.
Lost lock,
Randero reported, urging the dropship's computer to find the second missile again. Before he could jab a thumb on the button to authorize an active sensor pulse, the defensive computer made the decision and microwave energy blasted outward, this time in a broad beam intended to seek rather than destroy. Nothing. Nothing. No return pulse that could confidently be identified as the enemy missile. Nothing. Still nothing. Randero checked the instruments, frightened that the active sensor dome might have been damaged. Power could be flowing to the dome, but no microwave energy going outward. No. They were getting returns bouncing off the drifting chaff and pieces of the broken first missile. The sensors were working, just not...
Contact!
He breathed with relief as the second missile blasted through the layer of chaff. That was not good. They were too close. The maser turret resumed its bzz, bzz, but the defense computer didn't have enough time to analyze the flight characteristics of that missile as it jinked side to side on its path toward the target. The target. Their dropship.
This will be clo-
Bam! The second missile exploded, and for a moment Randero thought it had detonated its warhead on a proximity setting, in which case they were dead. They were not dead. Not right then. They were alive. The masers had hit the... Lalenda pulled the nose up just before they flew straight into the cloud of shrapnel. The big dropship shuddered, shivering in the air as hundreds of pieces of hot composite impacted the energy shields. A dozen, two, three dozen pieces seared through the shields and struck the dropship's belly, ripping through the thin armor plating and destroying belly jets, power cables, electric motors, and other vital components needed for controlled flight.
I've got nothing,
the pilot said in an even tone that masked the panic she was feeling.
No control.
The dropship began rolling to the left and kept going, flipping upside down. It stabilized there for a heart-stopping moment and wobbled, flipping the nose up and falling belly first.
Eject,
Randero called out, seeing the ejection menu automatically come up on his console. The flight control computer thought that ejecting was their best course of action and would automatically launch the pilots up and out unless they manually canceled the sequence. Lalenda looked at the purple ejection-enabled symbol blinking on her console. The flight controls were inoperative. Only the inherent stability of the airframe was keeping the ship from flipping into a death spiral. Ejection was the sensible thing to do. Except in the cabin behind the cockpit bulkhead was a Verdcrisp platoon, plus the human liaison, or advisor, or observer, or whatever the hell Captain Grace's official title was. Of the 41 souls who boarded the dropship to strap into seats in the cabin, 32 were alive. They were flying low and slow enough to survive bailing out. The question was whether bailing out was their best chance to live. No, the question was what did she and Randero owe to the aliens? The Verdcris were historically enemies of her people, regardless of what they avowed their current politics to be. The humans? They weren't historically anything. They hadn't been in the fight long enough, and their meager numbers could not make a difference either way in the war. Humans had come to paradise as conquerors and quickly realized they had been played for fools. Yet recently, the strange and primitive aliens had proven to be courageous, even useful. What made Lalenda's decision were factors she considered so quickly she wasn't even aware of thinking about it. She and Randero had trained with Getran Zolotas's platoon for 2 weeks and had gotten to know the aliens, even grown to like the platoon leader. Now, Zolotas was dead, killed by shrapnel from the second missile, and Lalenda oddly felt an obligation to his people. Also, they were coming down over hostile territory. Everyone aboard the dropship had better odds of survival if they were together. And finally, damn it, she was just not ready to give up on saving her spacecraft. Not yet.
Cancel the ejection, Lalenda ordered. Switching to manual.
Canceling ejection auto-sequence, Randero acknowledged without enthusiasm.
Flying a Lotentix-class dropship to a dead-stick landing was difficult even with all flight controls functional and coordinated by the computer. Attempting a dead-stick landing without the computer was suicidal, and he was surprised that the usually level-headed Lalenda would try it.
Are you sure that—
Partial flight control restored, she interrupted. Status symbols were scrolling on the console. She tentatively eased the nose up and banked to the left, discovering that a coordinated turn was not possible without manual inputs to the rudder.
Okay, she thought. I'm back in basic flight school.
Tell me what we've got working for belly jets. I won't know for sure until I fire them up, he warned.
Wait.
She held her breath as the dropship stabilized in a glide, the nose pitched down at 6 degrees. Time to look for a place to land, she told herself.
Do it!
Randero tested the jets one at a time, skipping the ones that were listed as inoperative by the computer.
Two. We've got two jets functional.
Waste of time, Lalenda grunted.
Two jets did not have enough power to hover the heavy spacecraft, and the two functional units were on the same side. Their thrust would only flip the ship on its side.
Dump the fuel. Venting fuel. Thrusters also?
He asked, finger poised over the button. She winced, rebuking herself. Her co-pilot should not have needed to ask for clarification.
No. We might need thrusters for the final approach. Vents open. Car.
He used her first name.
Tell me what you're thinking. Find me a place to land. We'll need a long rollout.
He enhanced the image of the ground below. Their objective had been to set down in a field behind a low ridge of hills to the west of the planet's only major city, touch down only long enough for the platoon to exit and to dump the supply containers out the back ramp, then lift off and fly low to the west, hugging terrain until they were over the ocean and could climb back into orbit to rejoin the assault carrier to land the second wave. That had been the plan. Now all Randero saw spread out below him was the planet's sprawling capital city. Other than the military base that lay southeast of the city center, there were no runways within the cone of their glide slope. A street. Their only option for a horizontal landing was a street. There were broad avenues in the city center, but they were arranged north-south, and there was a crosswind from the southeast. Plus, they would lose too much altitude swinging around for an approach from the north. He didn't like the idea of scraping the ship's belly on a street in a crowded urban area. The extensive suburbs surrounding the urban center had narrow streets overhung with trees. Damn, he thought, the squids really like trees. Even the highways leading into the city were lined with tall trees, with branches that would snag the dropship and flip it over. That left an industrial section of the suburbs, low rectangles of structures connected by grids of roads with few trees or other obstructions. The type of place every city needs for warehouses and factories and repair shops. Zooming in the image showed vehicles zipping recklessly along the roads as parking lots emptied, local residents reacting to the totally unexpected invasion. Parents rushing home to get their children and take them out of the city. Randero felt a pang of sympathy. He had two children at home.
This is our best option, he highlighted the street he had selected. I see it, she said. Tell our passengers to hang on for a rough landing. They need to egress as soon as we stop.
As the dropship lined up with the street selected for landing, Lalenda forced herself to breathe normally. The street was wide enough to clear the spacecraft's hull and half the wings on each side, but scattered trees, parked vehicles, and poles were going to clip the wings before they slid far. Vehicles raced along the street, the anxiety-driven speed spurred into panic when the drivers saw the dropship flying toward them. Just about at the spot where she was aiming to scrape the belly on the road surface, a sleek passenger car collided with a boxy tandem truck, and the truck veered away to crash into parked cars along the south side of the street.
Watch out, Randero warned. I see it.
She dipped the nose to gain airspeed, then hauled back on the stick, lifting the dropship's scarred belly just over the roof of the truck. Or almost over the truck. The dropship's tail clipped the trailer, crushing it, and throwing the ship's nose down to smack the road surface with a jarring thud, followed by a screech. The pilots could barely see through the smoke and debris thrown up as the former spacecraft skidded down the road, wings smashing parked vehicles. The right wing hit something unyielding, and the main spar broke, severing the wing off near the root. Slewing to the right, the dropship lurched off the street, crushing cars, bouncing over a ditch, and flopping into a parking lot.
"Car!"
Randero gasped, seeing they were racing toward the side of a building. There was nothing they could do to avoid the collision. They had no control.
"We're out!"
he shouted as he yanked on the emergency ejection handle. Above them, det cord burned openings in the cockpit hull, and they rocketed upwards nearly simultaneously, wrapped in nanofiber shells. The motors under the seats kicked them up and to the south, just high enough for the parachutes to deploy, the ejection computer having determined that dangling in the sky over enemy territory was not good for the health of the pilots. Braked at the last moment by their parachutes, the pilots came down in an alley between two warehouse-like structures, their seat rockets firing a last puff of thrust to cushion the impact. Randero collapsed the nanofiber shell around his seat, punching the button to release the straps that held him, and rolling awkwardly onto the broken pavement that was strewn with trash and a long, slick streak of scummy yellowish liquid coming from the bottom of a dumpster. He pulled a rifle from the back of the seat, checked it, and ran over to where his fellow pilot was crawling out of her own seat.
"Car, are you all right?"
he asked, swiveling his head left to right down the alley.
"Hurt my back,"
she grunted, using the seat to pull herself up.
"Bad? I can move. Grab your rifle. It's closing time."
"Closing time?"
She winced as she lifted the rifle out of its slot, sharp pain radiating from her lower back.
"Yeah."
Randero swung his rifle around as a door opened into the alley and a pair of curious Wirgalin stepped out. One of them held something that might have been a pistol.
"You know, closing time? We don't have to go home."
He fired two shots into the door as the pair of aliens ducked back inside.
"But we can't stay here."
Chapter 16. "Not yet," Irene whispered to herself. She was lying prone on the ground under pieces of nanofiber torn from Derek's seat, with twigs and leaves scattered on top of the fabric. With the fabric's chameleon wear concealing her and the fabric absorbing her heat signature, the Wirgalin had not yet detected her presence, though she had to be careful not to allow her helmet to transmit anything. She was alone. There had been an argument about that, a brief argument, but heated. Derek had wanted to stay behind, or stay with her. She had insisted one of them needed to assist the two injured soldiers on this side of the river. They knew from brief, staticky burst transmissions from the Maverick's platoon that Perkins had sent soldiers toward the river. They did not know when or if those soldiers would arrive. They did know, from the appallingly poor communication security of the approaching Wirgalin soldiers, that they were close and moving fast through the forest on their creepy tentacle legs. Derek had relented when Irene played the woman card, explaining that if one of the injured soldiers needed to be carried, a man could handle that task better than she could. That was bullshit. He had seen her hauling a 200-pound dummy in a fireman's carry during training, so he knew she could do it. And Derek was more persuaded because she said it than by the logic of her argument. Whether Derek had found Rivera and Zheng, she didn't know. They couldn't communicate without giving away their positions. And right then, Irene did not want the Wirgalin finding her. The four enemy soldiers must have seen Derek's seat first, coming upon the clearly alien object unexpectedly. That had slowed their approach and caused them to spread out. When they found the shell covering Irene's seat, one of them went forward cautiously, while the other three remained spread out and behind cover. She thought of the Wirgalin soldiers as it rather than she or he. They did have two genders, but she had no idea how to tell them apart. In their powered armor, it was impossible to discern the differences anyway. The one tasked with investigating the shell of her seat walked toward it on creepy tentacles in a jerky fashion, hesitantly.
Irene guessed it didn't like being ordered to check out a potential hazard, and the squid kept its own rifle pointed at the shell, but he didn't panic and start shooting. Darting an arm tentacle into the opening that had been torn in the shell, it leapt away, then walked forward to peer inside. Slinging its rifle in an odd pouch on its back, it walked all the way around the shell, stopping to pick up the yellow box that held the self-destruct charges. Irene held her breath. If the squid got curious, it might have cracked the box open to find that Derek removed the explosives and replaced them with dirt and stones. The explosive packs from his seat were now wired to the self-destruct mechanism inside her seat, and Irene had an icon in her visor ready to blow the seat to pieces. Not yet. The Wargalan was gesticulating wildly, and though she could only guess what it was saying, her helmet was picking up a transmission. That's right, she whispered under her breath. It's a big mystery, Squidlock Holmes. You all should investigate. Maybe crack open a couple squid beers and relax for a while. Two other Wargalan approached the upside-down seat, keeping their rifles ready and warily scanning the area. The first soldier held up the self-destruct box, showing the broken tab where it had split away from the seat, and the snapped wires. That had been Derek's idea, to make it look like the self-destruct had failed because it was torn away in the crash, make it look like the seat posed no danger at all. The three squids huddled, examining the box. Irene mentally urged them to get closer to the seat, yet they did the opposite. The two newcomers walking a circle around the shell, then standing still, possibly waiting for orders. The fourth soldier came out of the woods on the other side from where Irene was hidden. She had trouble seeing it through the trees. Finally, the other three walked to stand close to the shell, perhaps proud of what they had discovered. The fourth soldier, who Irene guessed was the leader, gestured with his rifle and the other three took a step away from the shell. That's when Irene blew it up. The Ruhar engineers who designed the ejection seats had specified not only enough explosive energy to melt the critical components they didn't want the Kristang copying. They added more energy so curious lizards would not be tempted to come anywhere near a seat that was still intact. When Irene eye-clicked the command, the self-destruct charges from two seats detonated together with the explosive force directed toward the opening torn in the shell. That is where Irene and Derek had hoped the curious Wargalan would be, and two of them were caught directly in the blast and flung up and away, their armored suits punctured. One of them splattered hard against a tree, the other just rolled and rolled until it came to a stop, unmoving. As the saying goes, curiosity killed the cat, but the third curious squid survived with two shattered leg tentacles and one arm tentacle flopping uselessly. Damn it! Irene could not see the fourth enemy soldier anywhere. Leaves, shredded bark, and bits of both ejection seat and Wargalan were floating in the air along with soot and smoke. She didn't dare risk an active sensor scan or standing up. Her flight suit didn't have power assist motors or armor, while the enemy soldier had both, plus rockets and probably a lot more ammo than the two magazines Irene had with her. There! A glimpse of something going right to left across her vision. It was fast. Bullets ripped through the forest in no particular direction. The Wargalan was using the time-honored technique of spray and pray, prodigiously expending ammo, but effective at forcing Irene to keep her head down. She needed the enemy to be afraid so it would retreat and let her escape. She remotely triggered one of the grenades she had placed in the crook of a tree, choosing the grenade that was vaguely in the direction where she had last seen the surviving Wargalan. Another long burst of rifle fire randomly chewed up the scenery, then a short burst. Her visor told her the rounds were coming from farther away, so she triggered the second grenade that had been placed under a pile of leaves to throw into the air as much view-obscuring material as possible. She used the explosion as cover to wriggle backwards out of the covering fabric, crawled on her belly to the stream bed behind her, then ducked down and ran along the stream, trying to keep her boots from splashing too loudly in the water. Her flight suit had chameleon wear, and she was concealed from motion sensors by being below the banks of the stream. But the Wargalan surely had acoustic sensors listening for any unnatural sounds. She had to find Derek and the two injured soldiers before the Wargalan turned around to hunt for her. Not that long ago, she had been aboard the Big Mac, going through pre-flight checks.
How could her day have completely gone to shit in such a short time? Dave Chaika and Jaitz splashed up onto the shore, both exhausted, slipping in loose sand and trying to step on the solid rock shelf that lay under most of the beach. Dave supported the Verd with the Surgeon's arm over his shoulder until they stumbled under cover of the trees at the top of the beach. You know, Dave grunted as he helped Jaitz sit down, his back against a tree. We shouldn't make a habit of this.
Of what?
Me helping you walk. This is twice in three missions now. The Surgeon nodded gravely.
I will strive not to be injured in the future.
Hey, I didn't mean... Sorry, man. We need to see where you got hit. Maybe I can do something with my medkit. I tried to ask your suit what the problem is, but its diagnostic system is acting funky.
Funky?
Jaitz asked, tapping the side of his helmet, indicating he had not heard or had not understood what was said. It means something isn't right. Let's get you out of that suit.
Jaitz looked up with a glare. You're not going to buy me dinner first?
What?
Ah!
Dave exploded with laughter. Jaitz still had a sense of humor. That was a positive sign.
Show me the goods first, honey. Jaitz looked around. I do not believe it is wise to remove protective equipment in a potential combat environment.
Hey, I got a newsflash for you, Surgeon. The Legion is scattered all over hell and gone. I have no freaking clue where the front lines are. Dave popped the seal and removed his helmet, keeping the microphone attached to one ear. All I do know is odds are no squids are wasting their time searching for us down here. He looked up at the sky where bright flashes still regularly lit up space near the planet. It looks real kinetic up there. I think the Wargalan have more important things to worry about.
I see your point. Chaika, use my medical kit. The nano is adjusted for my physiology.
Sure thing. Get your torso unsealed. I'll help you. You should leave your pants on. The Verd looked up at him with a grunt.
I think we both would prefer that.
A bright streak caught Dave's eye just as he was helping Jaitz move the right arm of the skin suit so they could get the torso unpeeled and see the extent of Jaitz's injuries. Dave released the skin suit fabric, letting it snap back into place.
What's the problem, Chaika? Jaitz growled, tired, achy, and irritated. You've seen me with my shirt off. You can't handle my manliness.
I can't handle your dumbassness, Dave shot back, tapping the control to reseal the shoulder joint.
Look!
He jabbed a finger at the sky. The burning streak was no longer just a bright line. It cut a swath across the sky coming from the east, with smaller contrails spreading to either side. At the head of the fire was a bulky object that was glowing orange and red, and it was getting larger. Dave squinted, then flipped his visor back down to use the suit's sensors. The object was almost directly overhead and falling fast.
Yeah, that's gotta be the Big Mac. The ass end of it.
Jaitz took a moment to think.
You could be right.
It's a ship anyway. Dave turned his attention to getting Jaitz's suit put back together. Let's get you mobile pronto.
What? The Verd Chris grunted with pain. Why?
Because that thing is going to hit the water. I'm kind of an expert on tsunamis. He thought back to when Shauna had made an island disappear on Paradise. We do not want to be on this beach when the wave hits.
Oh.
Jaitz shook his head, blinking, embarrassed that his mind wasn't functioning correctly. He looked to the ocean, then the range of steep, knife-edged hills that paralleled the coast inland. It would be a tough climb to the crest of the ridge.
Help me up.
He held out his left arm. We should get your right suit arm set up first.
I can carry the damned thing if I have to, Jaitz disagreed. We need to find out if this suit is functional.
You got that right. During the swim and the short walk up the beach, Jaitz had been dragging his right leg. The Verd insisted that his own flesh and bone leg was working fine. The suit's nanomuscle motors were not cooperating. Okay, try to stand up. Dave held out a hand and braced himself. Jaitz rose unsteadily, forcing Dave to hold on to a tree for support.
Let go, Jaitz ordered,
and took a step on his own, then another, and fell on his face in the sand. Awkwardly, he rolled himself onto his back and sat up.
"This suit is not functional," he announced in the stilted way the translator spoke.
Dave bit back a, "You think?" and looked out to sea, alarmed that the falling ship had passed overhead and arcing toward the water.
"Okay, get out of the suit, now. If you can't run on your own, I'll carry you."
Jaitz did not argue, and he didn't waste time. Usually, getting out of a Ruhar combat skin suit involved removing each piece separately, being careful to give time for the tiny connections in the joints to release properly. For emergency situations, there was a procedure where the nanofibers that held the suit together let go of each other on each side of the joints and seams. Basically, the suit would flop apart like an old set of sweat clothes that had gone through too many washes. The Verd pressed buttons on the wrist pad in the correct sequence, confirmed the command twice, and the suit sloughed away from him like a snake shedding its skin. The heavy backpack crashed to the ground, setting off sparks from the cracked power cells. Jaitz manually unfastened the belt that held grenades, his rifle, and spare ammo magazines. Waving for Dave to stay back, he held onto a tree and stood up. Or tried to stand. His right leg collapsed immediately.
"Oh, man, that don't look good," Dave observed.
Under the skin suit, the Verd wore a thin garment that had the virtue of not bunching up and chafing under the powered suit's liner. Blood had soaked Jaitz's ribcage and his right shin. Dave studied the leg wound. He guessed they had not noticed the leg injury because the suit had sealed a cut well, or maybe it had been blunt force trauma. Making a snap decision, Dave knelt down, facing away from Jaitz, and released his backpack. The power cells were built into the suit and couldn't be moved, but he could carry his gear on his chest instead of his back. The packed straps were designed to be attached front or back, and Dave had trained to walk, even run, with the pack on his front. The suit's computer adjusted its balance for the different center of gravity, so the only issue was that Dave had to be careful to hold his rifle so the pack didn't interfere. He figured if he needed to shoot, he would ditch the pack anyway.
"Okay, sling your rifle and belt over your neck and hop on my back. I'll have to carry you. Wait, I need to get gear out of my pack."
"Oh yeah." Dave should have considered that Jaitz would need his food rations. He couldn't eat the food Dave had in his own pack, and neither of them had any idea when they would link up with a Legion unit. They might be alone in the wilderness for a long time.
"Got it."
Jaitz finished stuffing something into Dave's pack, then grunted with pain as he put his legs through loops on either side of the pack that were intended for carrying an injured soldier. The Verd held onto other straps on Dave's shoulders instead of wrapping his hands around the human's neck.
"Stand up slowly. This sand is loose footing."
Dave didn't need advice from Jaitz. He had carried humans and Verds in training, and training courses usually included a sticky mud and obstacles that were more of a challenge than beach sand and scrub forest. The powered suit did most of the work, steadying Dave's wobbly legs. Walking, then jogging slowly, then breaking into an easy, controlled run, he kept one eye on the palm trees and scrub brush around him, while his other eye scanned the map in his visor. The hills inland were steep and came to a knife edge, but the ridgeline closest to the ocean was less than 100 meters high. Was 100 meters high enough to protect them from the incoming wave? He hoped so, because according to the map, east of the first ridge was a broad valley, then a tall cliff that appeared to be a sheer wall. Even in the powered armor skin suit, he would need climbing gear to get up the cliff, and he couldn't climb with Jaitz on his back. That meant getting to the top, lowering a line, and hauling up the injured Sergen. Dave didn't know how long they had until the tsunami hit, but he bet they didn't have long enough for leisurely mountain climbing. Getting up the first ridge was a struggle. It required scrambling over a pile of loose rock at the bottom of the slope. Dave's mind idly recalled that such a collection of stones was called scree, or possibly talus, and he had no idea why that mattered. He was a quarter of the way up the pile of rock, his boots sinking in up to his ankles, when he heard the long, low rumble of thunder. Instinctively, he flinched and looked up, just as the rolling clap of thunder shook loose rock on the ridge above him.
Shit!
He couldn't just duck and cover because then Jaitz would be exposed to the stones that were bouncing down toward them. On hands and knees, he crawled backward, not taking the risk of standing in the loose stones. He understood the thunder was actually a sonic boom from the broken starship that had passed overhead. Reaching the sand again, he walked backwards, trying to judge the path of falling stones and failing. With his power-assisted arms, he batted away bouncing rocks until one came at him that was too fast to avoid and too heavy to knock aside. He caught the rock with both hands, the impact throwing him backwards. Knowing there was an injured soldier on Dave's back, the suit computer twisted the nanomuscle motors at the waist so he fell on his side, one arm flung out to break the fall. That big rock was the last of the danger. The sonic boom's footprint had moved out to sea, startling life under the waves and making fish leap out of the water. There was a bright flash toward the horizon as the ship struck the water. Then the view was obscured by a dome of mist that rose like a massive sea creature.
"Wait, not yet," Jates cautioned as Dave moved to stand up. "Look."
The Verd pointed to the sky over the sea, where ragged white clouds were being violently twisted into new shapes.
"Shockwave," Dave acknowledged. "It will shake loose more rock from that hill. I'm getting behind those trees."
He pointed to a grove of palms.
"Not those trees," Jates argued, and Dave experienced a surge of irritation at his literal backseat driver. "The shockwave might knock those other trees onto us."
"Sure,"
Dave cringed, chastened. Jates was right. They faced two dangers, the compressed air rushing at them from the west, then stones falling from the east. First, he had to assure the shockwave didn't crush them under a tree. Crouching on the west side of a dense grove of swaying palms, he watched a fast-approaching ripple on the surface of the water.
"Here it comes," he announced, without needing to.
Jates could see the same thing even without synthetic vision.
"Hey, cover your ears," Dave warned at the last moment.
Then the tempest washed over them. So much sand and sea spray was churned up that Dave was blinded, not even his visor showing him anything but gray static. Keeping one hand resting against a palm tree so he could judge if it was going to fall and in which direction, he braced on one knee, waiting for the shockwave to pass on. How soon behind the blast of air would be the tsunami? The suit's computer didn't have that data. He hadn't expected it would. By the counter in his visor, only 20 seconds passed from when the shockwave hit to when Dave could see again. Wind was still swirling as air rushed in to fill the low-pressure area behind the shockwave. It was like being in a tropical storm, and the palm trees were swaying back and forth alarmingly over his head. Then, a rock shaken loose by the shockwave bounced past, and he turned to face the hill, keeping a particularly thick tree between him and the next hazard. When the stones rolling past had slowed to a trickle, he turned his head to shout at Jates.
"We need to move, before the wave hits."
"What?" Jates responded.
"Moving!"
Dave jabbed a finger at the hill and cautiously stepped out from behind the swaying grove of palms. A fist-sized rock bounced off his right knee, and he ignored it. The visor was showing more rocks bouncing down the hill, but nothing was highlighted in red. None of the falling objects was large enough to cause a problem as long as Dave made sure to keep Jates out of the line of fire. He got up the now larger and more solidly packed pile of stones at the bottom of the slope and began climbing, holding on to stubborn shrubs that clung to the hill or using his gloved hands to stab handholds into the volcanic soil. He estimated the slope was at a 45-degree angle, and it got steeper near the top. While he climbed, kicking footholds with his boots, he searched for the best route up over the ridge.
"Jates, you hear me?"
"Yes," the Verd coughed.
"Go! Climb faster!"
Dave climbed as quickly as he could, grateful that Jates was keeping out of his way as best he could. Still, the big alien on his back was a dead weight, and Dave's suit let him know that it was straining with the additional load.
"Hey,"
Dave said when he could catch enough breath to speak, about halfway up the hill.
"At least..." He paused to gulp air. "We now know one thing."
"What is that?"
Jates was also breathing hard.
"It's not just the suit,"
Dave grunted from exertion as he pulled them up around a jutting rock.
"You do have a fat ass."
Getting over the sharp crest of the ridge was a struggle. Dave had to pound handholds into the soft volcanic rock and pull the two of them up the nearly vertical slope. At one point, He paused to consider how best to tackle the final 8 meters to the top when Jates tapped the side of his helmet.
Chica, I don't want to distract you, but I seriously suggest you move faster.
Being careful to keep hands and feet securely dug into the hillside, Dave looked behind him by using the rear-facing camera built into his helmet.
Oh.
He grimaced when the first thing he saw was a super close-up view of the bird's ugly lizard face staring back at him. Tilting his head provided a better view of... The wave was piling up behind them. It wasn't a wave, exactly, not the gracefully curling white-topped form that would make a surfer's heart quicken. The entire surface of the sea was rising, north to south in an unbroken line. White foam crashed where the tsunami water piled over the outer reef, sending spray 50 meters into the air.
Shit!
Dave pulled his right hand out of the crevice he had pounded into the rock. Okay. He searched the last bit of the hill, up toward the crest.
Chica!
Jates shouted, his hearing still affected by the shockwave.
I can't walk, but I can climb.
He jammed a hand into the crevice Dave had just pulled away from, swung his good leg out of the sling, and found a toehold that seemed to be stable.
You go ahead and lower a line to pull me up.
You sure?
Yes, go.
Knowing the bird's injured leg made moving it awkward, Dave reached beside himself and released the sling from Jates' other leg.
Hang on,
he shouted without looking back, meaning the words literally. Without the burden of Jates that made climbing more difficult, Dave clambered up the slope, slipping and sliding backward, but making more progress up than down. When he was within arm reach of the ridge crest, he resisted the temptation to leap without thinking, and the temptation to look behind him. Knocking handholds in the dark gray rock took too long. He had to take a risk. Their own damned ship was trying to kill them, as if the ship's last act was to take vengeance on the biological beings that had failed it.
Hey, it wasn't my fault,
Dave said as he crouched down, letting go of the precarious handholds and flattening his chest-mounted pack against the almost vertical hillside as best he could. Springing upward on powered legs, he felt a toe catch the rock painfully, bending that foot down as he soared upward. The rock of the toe holds had fractured as he jumped, stealing power from the upward movement. One hand missed the crest. He got the other hand draped over the jagged edge of the volcanic rock, which began to crumble. Kicking with his feet did not find any purchase, and he was sliding backwards. With his other hand, he felt for a crevice or solid rock and managed to jam an index finger into a crack in the rock just long enough to swing his legs so the other hand got a better grip on the ridge crest. Pulling himself up with less care than he wanted and more care than he had time for, he heard the freight train rumbling roar of the onrushing water and felt the hillside tremble. Somehow he got a leg over the crest, which really was less than 6 inches wide, and flopped over the other side so only his shoulders were draped over the ridge.
Jates!
He shouted at the bird looking up at him.
Catch this!
As he tossed the line from his tool belt, Dave realized the Surgeon would need to let go with one hand to attempt catching the line, and that maintaining a solid grip on the wire-thin material would be nearly impossible without powered gloves to assist. He should have tied a loop before throwing. His mistake might kill Jates. Dave had forgotten something else. The line, though no thicker than angel hair pasta, was made of nanofibers by the Ruhar, and it was controlled by his suit. When Jates let go of the sheer hillside to catch the line, his other hand slipped, and he fell. One hand closed around the thin line, and it slid along his palm, cutting into his skin and not slowing his fall. The blood flowing from the cut made the line even harder to grip, and he jerked to a stop as the end of the line looped first around his wrist, then slithered creepily under his arms to secure itself.
Chica!
Jates called, but Dave was already hauling upward. The fast-moving wall of water had hit the beach and palm trees were flung about like matchsticks, the front face of the wave higher than the tallest tree. When Jates reached the top, the wave bashed itself against the base of the hill below and water rocketed upward, surging toward them. There was no time to help the bird get down the much gentler backside of the hill, and the line tying them together might only cut Jates in half. Dave hit the button to sever the line at his belt, and they both scrambled down the hillside for less than 2 seconds before they were enveloped in a whiteout of sea spray, then buried under water that blasted over the ridge and splashed down in a torrent. Dave didn't remember anything worth noting as he was swept along with the water. He went upside down and tumbled over and over as the flood of water carried him down to the valley below. Striking many unseen objects on the way, he was battered senseless several times and had the sensation of moving sideways, one way then another. His guess, without being able to see anything, was that the seawater had pooled in the valley east of the ridge, and now the sudden influx of water was seeking its natural level. The sloshing back and forth slowed, and he felt his boots touch bottom. With the suit providing a supply of air, he knelt and crawled along the bottom, feeling with his hands to determine which way was up to shallow water. When his helmet broke the surface, he could only tell by a slightly brighter darkness enveloping him. The suit's sensors were largely useless, being caked with mud. Wiping away all the mud would take too long, and he needed to find Jates. The Sergeant did not have a nanofiber skin suit protecting him, nor a supply of air. Popping the seal of his faceplate, he swung it up manually and blinked at the sudden bright light. The valley was full of fog, water droplets so fat they danced in the air. "Jates," Dave called, filling his lungs with sweet air to bellow the name. "Jates!" No response. Dave stood on shaky legs, turning completely around. The devastation in the valley was complete. Even the tall cliff to the east had water running off and mud caked 50 meters high. Broken palms and other mud-splattered trees bobbed in the murky water that still sloshed north and south and from one side of the valley to the other. Dave pulled his helmet off, wading out into the water to wipe mud off the sensors. If he could get the infrared sensor cleaned, he could search for a heat signature. Or he could try pinging the identification chip that all Legion soldiers had implanted in their forearms. It could be used as a crude locator beacon. Better than nothing. Nothing was all he had right then. "Damn it, Jates," Dave swore through tears. He couldn't believe the big Verd Chris Sergeant was gone. "I saved your sorry ass how many times? You can't die on me now, you jerk. Come on. Come on." He rubbed mud off the helmet's sensor lenses. "Come on, man, I don't know what I'll do without you," he sobbed, sinking to his knees. "You'll drown without me if you don't get out of that water," a weak voice whispered. "Jace!" Dave cheered, leaping up and splashing down to fall in the water over his neck, only holding on to the helmet by the strap looped around one finger. Sputtering and spitting out filthy seawater, he looked around and realized that one of the mud-splattered trees bobbing in the water had an arm wrapped around it. Jates's head jutted above the tree trunk just enough for one eye to have a view of Dave.
"I could," Jates coughed up seawater, "use some help."
Turning the helmet right side up to drain the water,